You're listening to Wine on the Vine with Lisa Mayaka, only on LA Talk Radio.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Thursday. I am your host for an hour of what I call shameless storytelling. My name is Lisa Mayaka, and I am thrilled that you are joining us today, whether that be on Facebook Live or on LA Talk Radio online. Both venues, if you will, are available after the fact. So you don't have to feel like you're missing out week after week. You can download the audio version after the show airs. And for at least a week after we are live on Facebook, you can continue to watch on both LA Talk Radio's Facebook page as well as mine. And mine is called Wine on the Vine, W-H-I-N-E, the sponsor of today's show. I am so gifted by the universe to meet so many wonderful people across the course of my life. And I'm just sitting in this space today, very grateful for these opportunities that come my way. This happens to be, I mean, who knew? This is National Card and Letter Writing Month. Hello. I was informed of this via spam email a couple of days ago, but I went, oh, what better introduction for today's show and today's guest than this. Letter writing is one of my favorite things to do when nobody's looking. My mama taught me to write thank you notes. If someone blesses you with a gift or their presence or buys you dinner or what have you, you send a thank you note. And you sit for a moment in the space of contemplation about what that gift, that blessing meant to you. And then you think about what words you want to say back to them, because words matter. And in that communication, which used to be a kind of a regular thing, now I don't think it is very much, except for today's guest, who is a master, if she'll let me say it, at writing letters to the editor. She was published just this week in the New York Times for one of her letters to the editor, as she has been before. And she and I probably would agree on this whole like letter writing thing that seems to be a lost art. So I'm really, really tickled about her presence on the show today. I will tell you, though, that I bumped into her writing in a whole different way. Last summer, in the height of COVID, when all of us were sitting at home, twiddling our fingers, having binge watched everything that was available on Netflix and looking for something else to do with our time and our creativity, I enrolled in a writing class through Literary Cleveland. As you know, I'm a graduate from Case Western Reserve University. If you're watching on Facebook, I am now pointing at my degree to prove to you all out there that I am actually educated, despite what you might think. But in collaboration with Literary Cleveland, the university offered a writing class, and this was open to anyone. And so I entered this classroom with trepidation and excitement. I was so glad to finally give a bit of my time every week to a passion, but also I feel a calling of mine to write. But I haven't devoted the necessary discipline to that call as I should have in the past. So anyways, COVID set me up, right? So I logged on to this class. And in this class, we were provided prompts week after week. And then we were basically ordered a 15 to 30 minutes every day and just write. Use the prompt and then whatever came after that, just write it out. And then here's the kicker. On the weekly connections that we did over Zoom, we would read our writing out loud, one to the other, for the sake of feedback, creative criticism, support, etc. And in this class, the majority of the participants hailed from Northeastern Ohio and or the East, but there was one outstanding member of the class who lives in Palo Alto, California. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. There's two of us on the West Coast that are writing and subscribing to a Cleveland class. But then I heard her first submission. And without being too dramatic, my jaw dropped a bit. And I was behooven to her story, particularly when I realized it had actually happened. And so I bring you today a wonderful woman who has now become, I believe, we're a little bit beyond just acquaintances. We have met in person and have pen-palled back and forth and had extensive conversations on the phone. So I want to welcome my friend from Palo Alto, Natalie. Natalie, hi, middle is your Krauss, your former name? Do I call you Natalie Krauss Beavis?
I do use all three names. It's my maiden name, Krauss.
Okay, welcome.
Thank you, Lisa.
You're here. She's not here without a little bit of pushback. She's like, why would you want me on your show? And I said, because you have so many stories within, and whether you believe it or not, so many worthy stories to tell. And the one that I'm inviting you to tell today, you have just recently submitted, am I right, for publication?
Yes, that doesn't mean it will be published, but I submitted it.
So we both believe in this story, and it actually happened to you.
Correct.
And are you ready and willing to just read the story? How do you want to move forward?
I can just read it. I was trying to remember, Lisa, what the prompt was. And I can't really quite remember. It might have been, I remember.
It was. Yeah. She gave us, I remember as the first prompt, but then she emailed us like we could have some versions of I remember. And so like mine stemmed from, I can't remember. And I went from there, or I don't remember, but I remember was the initial prompt. And that was our very first assignment for this class. And this was the very first submission that you read to all of us.
Right. So shall I go ahead and read it?
Would you please?
Okay. The civics lesson. Arabs cut off the hands of thieves, Mrs. Horn says, and they brand criminals on the forehead like the mark of Cain. I am sitting in the first row, middle seat, in Mrs. Horn's ninth grade civics class in 1961. Mrs. Horn is, as usual, pacing back and forth past my desk, 3 feet to the right and 3 feet to the left. Sometimes she stops in front of my desk to face the class and to give emphasis to what she is saying. We should punish thieves and criminals in the United States the same way, she continues. We should cut off their hands and brand them. When she stops pacing, I often stare at her brown Oxford shoes and at her impressive bulging calf muscles. Mrs. Horn is also the gym teacher. Her short gray hair and her no-nonsense white blouse and A-line brown wool skirt seem suited to her other position. Mrs. Horn has already walked past my desk to the right and is about to pivot. I consider what she said as I suppress any evidence of surprise from my face. What if the thief was hungry, I think, and he stole to buy food for himself and for his family? Justice would not be served with such an extreme punishment. Mrs. Horn starts walking to the left. Mrs. Horn goes on. Hitler got some things right, too. She has just walked past my desk and nervously, quickly glances over her left shoulder, and she remembers, I am there. I am the only Jewish child in the school. She tempers what she is saying. Of course, he did a bad thing by killing Jews. Jews are good students and not common criminals. But Hitler did do a good thing by killing handicapped people, deformed and retarded people, she says. They are useless feeders and a drain on society. My head is down. I'm looking at the hem of my pleated plaid wool skirt resting on the upper edge of my knees and at my feet in penny loafers on both sides of the T-bar of my desk. I look once at Mrs. Horn's bulging calves as she paces past. With my head bowed, I glance quickly to the left and to my right to assess the reaction of any of my classmates. Mrs. Horn has just declared that she approves of Action T4, Hitler's killing of disabled people, as a trial run before he killed Jews, gypsies, dissidents, homosexuals. As he raised his hand about to bring it down on the head of an overseer beating a slave, Moses looked left and right. Was he looking to see if anyone else was willing to stand up to the injustice he witnessed? Is Mrs. Horn a Nazi, I fear? Was she a member of the American-German Bund? I look to the left and to the right once more, looking for support, but the faces of my classmates are ciphers. We are only 14, after all. Do my classmates know that what Mrs. Horn said was immoral? I look back at my shoes and then at Mrs. Horn's calves. When I come home from school that day, through the back door into the kitchen, my mother is standing at the counter, chopping an onion on a wooden cutting board. I drop my books on the kitchen table and rush to tell her what had happened at school. Mommy, I say, Mrs. Horn told us in civics class today that although Hitler did bad things, he did the right thing by killing handicapped people who are useless and only feeders. My mother inhales a long, deep, angry breath, her shoulders and chest rising. She silently puts the knife down on the cutting board. She turns away from the counter, her teeth clenched, and her arm shoots out for the yellow phone on the kitchen wall. I'm calling the school, she announces. It's not yet 4 o'clock. She could succeed at reaching someone. No, no, I protest as I begin to cry. You can't do that. I'm calling the school, she insists as she cradles the receiver between her cheek and shoulder as she searches through the phone book for the number and begins to dial the school office. I fall on my knees to the kitchen floor. I grab the hem of her skirt, tugging on it as I beg her to hang up. You can't call the school, I cry. I begin to use the hem to wipe the tears from my face. Mrs. Hornet will know it was you, I plead, and I will pay for it. I won't say who's calling, my mother tells me. But no other mother would call, I say. She'll still know it was you. My mother is the avenging angel. She was one of the few Jewish mothers in our tiny mill town, where other parents are often recent immigrants from Eastern Europe. They don't have the language, the agency to challenge teachers. Maybe no other children even came home to tell their parents what Mrs. Horn, civics teacher, reveals about her ideal government. Mrs. Horn will know who called to complain. My mother relents and slams the phone back on the hook and returns to furiously chopping onions. There is no consequence for Mrs. Horn's fascist civics lesson. One day at the school where I teach, some 50 years later, I am waiting my turn to use the copy machine. I'm chatting with my colleague from Turkey, Aylin. She occasionally harvests the bunches of copies as the machine spits them out. We begin discussing a news story about a teacher who had been fired because of racial conspiracy theories she had posted on her private Facebook account. I tell Aylin about the civics lesson, about Hitler, about Mrs. Horn's approval of Action T4, about my mother wanting to call the school to report her. But in the end, no one ever knew. So many years have passed that I now have more information about Mrs. Horn because at my sister's high school reunion, my sister had recently seen Mrs. Horn's son. Mrs. Horn, I tell my colleague, Aylin stops gathering bunches of copies. The machine continues to whir and to shoot out paper behind her as Aylin turns completely to face me. Allahu Akbar, she whispers. God is great. That's my story.
That's one hell of a story, Natalie.
I just couldn't imagine a more perfect ending, really. And I don't know. I don't know what she did about that autistic grandson.
So,
divine revenge.
There's so many directions I would love to take this conversation. You and I have had a few before the show. I themed the show based on your suggestion, on guard, a French term for fencing, kind of where that position starts. But your point.
Pay up.
Say more.
Yes, think, no, you're holding it up, facing up, right?
Yes.
Like intention.
Intention, right?
Ready to go.
In fencing, that is. But your initial suggestion for that to be the theme came from what thought process?
Well, you know, if I really start way back, I didn't tell you this, but I was really, really, really little. I do not remember a time in my life that I did not know that my mother's family perished in Europe, her mother's family. That I think my grandmother basically until just about 3 years ago, I thought she was the only one who survived. But I did find a cousin. I did find a cousin who survived. But the family perished. My mother would say they were made to dig their own graves and shot into their graves. And I was named for my grandmother's brother. And I always knew this from the time I was three, which is a terrible thing for a three-year-old to know. So I think I always grew up afraid. I always grew up afraid about what people could do, you know, and you know, like what we're dealing right now, like with George Floyd. I'm just making this connection now. I'd say my mother would say, and she would cry, and she said, do you imagine they were made to dig their graves and lined up and shot even children into graves? And then the soldiers, you know, shoveled the dirt over. And I'd say, mommy, why didn't the police stop them? And my mother would say, they are the police. They were the police. And I didn't know what that meant. I'd say, I don't understand. Right? And she told me the same thing about segregation because I grew up in that era too. You know, and she'd tell me that black people had to go to the back of the bus. And I'd say, but mommy, why don't the police stop them? And my mother said, they are the police. You know, they enforce it. So that was, you know, a very, very young introduction to what people can do to each other and fear for myself, you know, being very wary, being the only Jewish kid my age in my class, that people could hurt me. So this is why I feel like I've always been on guard since I was three, really. Because even my name Bivas, this is a remnant of the Inquisition. This is the remnant of the Inquisition.
Yeah, I just bumped into that conversation with you before we went live on the air. Like someone heard your name and recognized where you come from and clearly connected you with the history that comes from that region. So there's no escaping that, even if you wanted to.
No, I realize that almost everyone I know is pretty much a refugee from somewhere. My husband's a refugee from Egypt. But they were refugees from Spain. That's all they
are. So where do you and he feel safe? Where are you safe?
They went by way of Turkey or Greece.
I think our connection's a little.
I don't ever feel safe. That's
ever?
Yeah, I don't ever. Not really. But, you know, I feel like it's a good position to be in because then I understand how other people don't feel safe.
Well, now you're setting me up. I mean, this story is your story. But the blog that I derived and wrote and will publish in a couple of hours when we're done with the show, basically takes that on guard position, which as a child is only defensive, right? I mean, you're just like freeze, fight, flight. Like you don't know what's happening. Your very identity has been assaulted by some person that's bigger than you, has power over you and says things. And then you go home and question, is any of this true? And if it's not true, then why does this person believe this and say this and treat me this way? And then from that young age, would you say you were 14? 14. So really just coming of age as a young lady to this point in life, I know because we've talked that it has affected you in having to be on the defense many, many times. But now you just speak about empathy. So tell me what that's about.
Well, I was never a kid who could ever bully somebody. You know, I sort of being in painful situations or being other people grew up in Pennsylvania, you grew up in Ohio, they weren't segregated states. But I mean, we're just on the Mason-Dixon line. I mean, new people, you know, the kids black kids were, you know, not allowed to go to the same schools and couldn't drink from the same water fountains. And, you know, I couldn't for a moment ever understand how.
Okay, but flash forward now. You grew up, you got educated, you traveled all over the world. You married your husband, also a refugee. You ended up teaching as a reading specialist, not something you wanted to do because you have a degree in art history. And I'm sure you had all kinds of other notions for your life. But here you end up in a classroom and you have another story that we talked about.
Right. Do you want me to just tell that story?
Do you want to tell that story?
I can, sure. I also think one of the blessings I think of my my job was I also taught English as a second language and reading, and often those children intersected because a good way to help a child learn a language is to start reading with them, right? This is how they grow their vocabularies.
Right.
So I got to meet kids from everywhere. I mean, from Ethiopia to, I don't know what the other side of the world would be, to Estonia. That's pretty far north.
It is.
Oh.
And where was this? Were you in California?
And I was quickly the kids who ended up in our school. Mm-hmm. We had 17 languages. You know? So I get very annoyed. That's a side story, but I get very annoyed when people talk about California schools. I mean, we're trying to educate the world at the same time. You know, we have so many kids who aren't even English speaking, and they're not Spanish speaking. They're all everything speaking. But
17
like,
languages.
I mean, not too many. Arabic is the language of Ethiopia. Excuse me?
I can't even name
them. Sorry, I didn't hear what you
languages.
Said. Yeah, well, see. You know, like what Urdu is and Amharic and right? But so anyway, I have all kinds of kids and I think I told you, I don't, you know, because I'm always on guard, I try not to ever let them know that I'm Jewish. I'm uncomfortable with that because I don't know what their parents think. I mean, because I've had kids who from the United Arab Emirates and from Libya, from Syria, from Egypt, and I don't, you know, and I don't know, like from Russia, I don't know what their parents would think, right? So I kind of avoid talking about Christmas or anything that would sort of give me away. But I had this little boy who was Samoan and 6 years old in first grade. And it was towards the end of the year. And every day I would pick a little new book for them to read that they could read the entire book in one sitting, about 200 words. And it was called The Hanukkah Party. And it was not religious at all. It was about a family making potato pancakes, and the father lets them slip off the platter onto the floor, and the cat eats them, licks them, and it looks like they're going to be stuck with cheese and crackers until grandmother arrives with a fresh platter of potato pancakes.
Hey, Grandma.
So I pull it off the shelf, and I say, Jacob, today's story is called The Hanukkah Party. And he said, oh, no, 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 I'm not reading that. I hate harmonicas.
Harmonica.
Harmonicas. And I thought, well, it sort of sounds like Hanukkah. Let's see if I understand what he means. So I said, do you know any harmonicas? And he named the two Jewish kids in his class. So I was clear what harmonica meant. And I didn't, and you know, and it was that terrified feeling that I felt like all my life, am I going to reveal myself? You know, like when someone, you know, and
he's the child or the teacher.
Excuse me?
You're the teacher in this situation. He's
the child. He's a six-year-old, but I'm afraid of him, right? Wow. We're one-on-one, and he's sitting on my left side, a little six-year-old, and I'm afraid of him. And I don't know what to do. You know, I mean, I had that momentary, like, your blood drains and time starts to go slowly. What am I going to do? And I did say to him, took me a while to work up the courage to say, you know, Jacob, I'm a harmonica. And he said, "You can't be. You can't be a harmonica. You just can't be. Do you speak harmonica?" And I wasn't sure which language qualified as harmonica, because there are three I could think of. There's Hebrew and Yiddish and Ladino. I know a little bit all three, but I said, "Oh, I do speak harmonica." And he kept saying, "You can't be, you can't be, you can't be. You know, this is cognitive dissonance and you're watching it happen in someone's little teeny weeny head." It was the end of the lesson. So, you know, I think you asked me, what did I do? I think I just let him go back to his room. But, you know, and I told you, I never told any of my colleagues. I never, ever told anyone. I guess if I look at it, I have to think there's a lot of shame involved, right? But that's really what I've internalized. So see what I mean? I can understand a little bit what it's like to be Black. Obviously, I can't understand because it's certainly a much greater problem. But I understand a little bit, right? Because you turn it inward.
Well, I don't know. I can't tell you what you feel. I think it's being the other that's being outed or being less than human.
Exactly. You understand what it's like to be the other. So I can't understand everyone's unique experience, but I get what it feels like to be the other. And that part of that is like you turn it on yourself, you know? So I felt so uncomfortable. I never told anybody. But the next day he comes in sort of sheepishly with his head down. And he said, "You know, my name's in the Bible." And part of me was very amused because Jacob is our progenitor, right? Jacob was renamed Israel.
Yes.
And we are the people Israel.
Yes.
He's the name of my people. I'm named for him. And, you know, B'nai Israel. And he says, "My name's in the Bible." Now, his parents had lost custody of him because the father was a third-time felon. And the mother was a drug addict. So the grandparents, who I think were religious, as often these Pacific Islanders are very religious Protestants, I guess the grandparents were probably very religious, and they probably were very embarrassed when he came home and told the story his teacher was a harmonica. And that he told the teacher, I hate harmonicas. And they probably felt really very embarrassed. And they told him, "You know, you can't do that. These are people of the Bible, and we believe in the Bible, and your name is from the Bible." And so it was left there, but
you said something really, really cool.
Everyone I've told, pretty much, I mean, Jewish people, they laugh because they think it's so funny about the harmonica part, but you know, it was actually really painful.
Yeah. I mean, it's a clever story as far as the word mispronunciation, but unpacking it it's not funny at all. And this is a 6-year-old who's been taught somehow to hate people he's never met, except he has met you and he can't hate you because he loves you. So then it's like, what's he do with that?
He pretty much did love me because I'm really nice to my kid. I was really nice to my kid.
Well, you know, talked about on the phone the other night, we talked about one of my favorite social workers, because that's my training, Brené Brown, right? She's probably the most famous social worker, at least in America right now. But she has this whole, on all her studies about vulnerability and empathy and things like that, she states that if we just move in or move close to another human being, it's really hard to hate somebody when we share space and stories, because all of the sudden we both realize how human and similar we are. Has that unfolded for you outside of this little boy's experience?
In which direction? In my understanding others or others understanding me?
Excellent question back. I would invite you to answer on either side of that.
Like I said, I think it was so lucky for me, I think, to meet all these little children and their families from everywhere, you know, because I often, like, I saw my children, mostly I saw them one-on-one, and I'd walk to their classroom and then walk them back. And so often I'd be walking with them and thinking, how could people kill children? How could you hate a child? You know, this is just a cute little kid, right? And you know, like my grandmother's family, I mean, some of them were children. Like, I know one was one of my mother's cousins was 13 when she was murdered. and the cutest little girl, Berta, you know, and we know it happens all over the world. And think, how could you hate a child? You're just a kid, right? And so that's true. And, you know, I wrote this story about what Hitler did to what this teacher thought Hitler was okay about doing. But, you know, I found something else about the people in my town, and only just like within weeks. My town was mostly Eastern Europeans, the Ukrainians, Poles, Russians, Slovaks, Croatians. Basically, these were people who really were pretty helpful to the Hitler, you know, in killing Jews. So there was also that level of fear too, because these were people who came from the countries that, you know, my family escaped from. But this is what I didn't know. My friends that I grew up with, and we were a cohort, we were trapped. So we pretty much stayed together for most of our school years, same 25 kids. A lot of them I didn't know were born in Europe. A lot of my friends, because, you know, when you're teenagers, you don't talk about this stuff. I didn't know they were born in Europe. And they were born in DP camps, even though they weren't Jewish, because Hitler killed Ukrainians. I didn't know that. They were gathered up, and they were called the Easter Biter, the Eastern workers. He so despised Slavs that they were made into, you know, the word slave comes from Slav. You know, they were made into slaves. Like my very good friend's mother, I had no idea. She was a slave in an Austrian household. Her sister was shot in a firing squad. I didn't know this happened to my friend's classmates. I didn't know that their parents were in DP camps because they were Ukrainian, not because they were Jewish. You know, and so many of my colleagues who were from Vietnam, for example, they were refugees too. I mean, you know, so from Nicaragua, you know, there's so much suffering and hatred. And you know, and you see, that's why it is good to have these experiences, because I didn't know, you know. If you're just always with people who are just like you, you never find this out. And I didn't even know this about my own classmates until like 3 months ago, that at least two of them were born in DP camps and their parents were slaves. And they were slaves because they were Ukrainians. Did you know that?
No, Hitler, not entirely. I did know Ukrainians were part of the targeted population because I've spent time in Ukraine with some orphanages. But no, not to that. To that degree. And I feel like we should have hit pause a minute ago and we should have dropped the microphone when you said you didn't know until you listened and learned. And now I'm careful. I don't want to ask a leading question, but I totally want to ask a leading question.
Go ahead.
Because I have a blog I'm publishing tonight. And here's my end game. I want to believe that these horrific atrocities, these traumas that have come at us for no good reason, just because we exist in this broken world, can be transformed into something better than what they were intended for. And what I hear from you is some form of empathy. One, you're so interesting to listen to because you're so specific about what happened without being dramatic and victimized. You know, you're not self-victimizing. You just tell the story. But like, if I spend any time with the story you're telling, I just want to go hide and cry because this is hideous. It's hideous, the things that you've told me about today. And yet here you are, strong back, soft front, engaged with humanity. You don't hide completely. You write letters to the editor. You're on my show today. You're sending these stories off for publication. You know that they're worthy of being told, but they're really scary to put out there. So what's happened in all these years that you have had to hide your identity, protect your Jewishness, or feel these darts on your being, your identity and your soul, but still show up? Because you're a very loving, kind person.
Well, I don't know. I guess I was raised to think that what was done to you is what you don't do to other people. I'd like to think that the hateful element that we're seeing in our country right now, they just don't know these stories. But maybe I'm naive, right?
No, I think there's a lot of truth to that. I mean, just like letter writing. I don't think my children, one generation removed, write letters like I taught them to, because it's just not what that generation does. I think there's a lot of disconnect between the stories that you're telling me and the understandings that you have of things that have gone on, history, and the world in which we operate day in and day out.
Yeah, I want to go back to the Ukrainian story because, you know, these were people I was taught to fear, because what I found out was that people on the other end of those rifles that shot my family into mass graves were not Germans, they were Ukrainians, right? So these were people that I grew up fearing. I had no idea that they suffered too, see? It just changes your point of view. And I didn't know that Hitler, Ukraine was like his backyard. You know, he wanted to extend his property, right? He thought, mm-hmm. The Germans need to stretch a little. We need to take over Ukraine so we can have bigger backyards.
Yeah.
And I just, mm-hmm. This is a big backyard. And I just really didn't know that. And it just makes a big difference to learn these things. You know, there's a program called, some high schools offered called History on Ourselves. It's the kind of thing that these states like Louisiana and South Carolina would probably never allow in their schools, but it really focuses on these stories to kind of sensitize kids to what, you know, what happens when you let hatred slip out.
And what happens when you only listen to one side of any story?
Well, of course it makes you narrow, but...
But that's often all we have, right?
It hurts because you want to have your own narrative.
Right. And that works for us.
Right.
Until it doesn't. Or until some version of the truth or whatever really happened comes our way. And then we're like, you know, then you have to question everything. So... Along those lines, I was so proud of myself for pre-recording last week's show with my girlfriend, Deanna, and kind of giving her the whole spiel on what the H in Wine on the Vine means to me, because it's kind of deep and it stems from my theological training. But I think I spoke too soon, because then I went to lunch with you the next day. And I learned a whole different perspective on how some Jews, Hebrews, see the name of God and pronounce this word for God. And so, like, this is just to me, if you're willing, I don't know if you are, but a beautiful segue, because you have introduced me to the other side of a plethora of stories. I think it's why I'm so keen on you right now. I just want to lean in and listen to you talk all day long, because I feel like, oh, maybe I have to go back to history class and rewrite some of what I learned. But at least to hear it from the perspective of someone who was trained early on, right? Were you raised in Hebrew?
Nope.
When did you learn it?
I'm only learning Hebrew. I'm a really a beginner. I'm
okay.
Really a beginner.
But were I'm you really raised in Judaism?
Yes. And no. my parents were very, very loose. You know, my mother grew up in a very religious household. Oh my God, I have another story. My mother grew up in a very religious household, and she felt that it was so much work for her mother to maintain everything that she said, I'm not doing any of this. And I don't know what kind of household my father grew up in.
She was like, forget it.
She absolutely, and this was not uncommon, I've heard.
Mm-hmm.
She thought her mother worked so hard, you know, to make keep the family on track that
I feel that.
She didn't want anything to do with it. And but you know, we lived in this little town where there were only a few of us, so they had to kind of pretend a little bit. And I don't know what kind of household my dad in, but you'll like this story. I think my dad, I don't think that they were deeply religious, but my dad was always really an entrepreneur. So he and his brother, they were little, maybe like preteens or something. They were selling peanuts on the train, like the Pittsburgh commuter train. And they had this idea that if they sold ham sandwiches, they could make more money.
It's a scheme.
So they don't normally have ham in their house, right? And there weren't really restaurant codes then. So they had a scheme. I guess they gathered their pennies together and they bought a ham. And they slid it in the basement window. And in the basement, they were making ham sandwiches to sell on the train for a great profit. But I guess they got caught. They probably got punished. But anyway.
Wait, did they get punished for what? For being
having a ham in the house.
Yeah.
But the idea that they would even contemplate bringing a ham in the house makes me think they weren't particularly observant. So my mother never served ham, but she served bacon. I don't remember this story, but by one day the doorbell rang on a Sunday morning, and our kitchen was in the back of the house, like most East Coast houses. There was the front door and the kitchen, the back of the house.
Yeah.
And the doorbell rings, and my father says very loudly, while my mother's cooking bacon, "Well, good morning, Rabbi Gavantman." My mother opened up the kitchen window and threw the bacon out the window.
And all the bacon smelled.
And I guess they hoped he didn't know how it smelled. But that is the household I grew up in. But I've become
more. You have this keen understanding of your traditions.
Yes, that is true. I've far exceeded my upbringing.
Why?
I don't know. It was an impetus that mattered to me. Although, I have another story. Do you know the high priest, uh-huh. right? He's made to be a bad character in the Christian Bible. But the high priest, he was appointed by the Romans, by the way. He was not, you know.
Yeah, it was a political appointment.
It was a political appointment, just like King Herod, who was, you know, sort of very Roman friendly.
Mm-hmm.
So, but over the last few decades, you know, with DNA, they've discovered that there is a marker for people who claim to be descended from the high priest. And usually those people are named Cohen, because that's what it means, high priest. And we don't have the name Cohen. But because of my two male cousins who had their DNA done, I've discovered that I am actually a high priest. And that's what I call myself now. I'm actually a high priestess. And my one synagogue allows women to now act
to
like
hold that pose. So tell me what that means to you. What does that do for you?
You know this, you know, the Vulcan.
Shin.
The Vulcan sign.
The shin, right?
Yeah, when you have it together, yeah.
Yes.
For you. So I get to hold my hands up over the congregation on my holidays.
I know the shin.
So I don't know. I mean, I joke that maybe it was like my genetic makeup, my DNA that has the priest. You know, we don't really know if it's the high priest, but we know that we have a common father who enters the family tree about 3,000 years ago, who, if your name is Cohen, you believe that person was Aaron, Moses' brother, who was the first high priest. Doesn't mean that really that's true, but it's remarkable that people named Cohen all have that gene, all have that DNA, and I have that DNA too, even though my name's not Cohen, or Katz, or Kahan, or Khan, or Cain. Those are all, you know, like Kahuna. Just like Kahuna.
Oh my God, I have so many directions I want to take the conversation, but we have to wind it down. So, dang it, there's so much more I want to talk. So when we were talking, we weren't talking about the shin, we were talking about, hey, that.
Yeah, so anyway, that's it. I don't have that really such a strong background, but maybe my impetus was actually my genetic.
It was huge because you said you corrected me in the way that Christians, which is my background and my training, say Jehovah or Yahweh are, is not really your perception or take on God.
Never use those words.
Ever.
Ever.
Tell me more.
Well, both of those are a misunderstanding of what the letters that we is God's name with a yud, a hey, a vav, and a hey, and we don't know how to say it.
It's unpronounceable, unspeakable.
It's unknowable, I guess is better to say. We don't know how to say
unknowable.
It. Maybe, but we don't know how to say it. So when we see those letters, we don't say Yahweh or Jehovah. We say Adonai, which means Lord. And that's what we say.
Why do you say that? What's that? How does that? Where does that get us close? Why? Inquiring minds need to know.
Why is it translated as Lord?
Why do you say Adonai? Why do you avoid the ha and the hey and the?
Because there are any number of vowels. There are. I think I said I did. Maybe I didn't send you that one. But there's another, because you could choose a number of vowels to go underneath. And the vowels will change the meaning. So is it ha or he or hi or ho or who? We don't know.
So for us to have added vowels that make a pronunciation doable for us is really offensive.
Well, you know what? Actually, we had a very, very brilliant rabbi who just retired, and she did bring this up once, how Yud-Heh, Vav-Heh became Yahweh or Jehovah. And I don't really remember the details, and I can't really annoy her and write to her and ask her because she's retired.
Oh, you totally can. Do it on my behalf. But you, okay, so these same letters, the hey, the H-E-I, that two of which are comprised in the unknowable name of God, are also in the word that we call love. Yes?
There are two hays in the word love, yes.
And what is that word?
Ahava.
Ahava.
Mm-hmm.
What does that word mean to you?
Well, literally it means love, but I think it's interesting that it's like there's so much breath in the word, right? There are two us, right? Ahava, right? You have to breathe to say it. I'm sure the mystics have had plenty to say about it, but I don't know what it is. But I'm sure I'm not the first person who's noticed that.
Well, I think it's so interesting because the breath is where the meaning holds sway for me. It's the breath of God that was added, the breath of the unknowable, unspeakable deity that was added to humanity for divine sake, not because we deserve it, but for divine sake. And I think it's fascinating, and we can draw whatever correlations, conclusions we want, that love contains two breaths.
It's the breath of life, right?
Twice over.
But this is, I'm not a Talmudist or anything, you know? I mean, I've been accused of that from time to time by accident.
So have I, and I'm not Jewish. Oh,
really?
People argue everything.
Like a Talmudist?
Uh-huh.
I've been told that too. I'm very flattered to be told I think like a Talmudist, but I'm not a Talmudist, but you know, it's a very big compliment, right? Because it means really you really think, right? You think and you question, right?
It does. And I think it's a really good place to kind of land the plane here for us. I think one of the things that I knew right away about you, Natalie, that I appreciate beyond measure is what I desire everyone who engages with me to also arrive at eventually. You can throw tomatoes at me. You can walk out of the room with anything I say, as long as you are critically thinking. You can hate it. You can argue back. I don't care. Like, I loved it when my kids became teenagers and they just started spouting back at me, because that means their critical thinking is in development. They have their reasons why what I'm saying does not work for them. Love it. Love it. It's when, you know, we sit here like little birds and open our mouths and swallow whatever comes down the pike. Like, we can't think for ourselves. That I can't do in a world like that. And you're the same. You write these letters to the, so her letter to the editor this week, published in the New York Times, was all about the profound lack of toilets for females on the planet. That shit needs to change. So, so interesting. You can find her name in the New York Times this week. Hopefully she'll come back for another conversation about who knows what. But Natalie, I'm so honored that you were so brave to share these stories with me today. Thank you.
It was fun. I thought I would be afraid, but this was just like a conversation in the living room. It was fine.
Yes, in your whatever room you're in that you had to clear the toilet paper out of, and my office where I had to get all the mess out of the way in order for us to go live. So
this is the garage.
This is where the glory happens. It's not in a formal studio. It's just conversations with regular people who have lived some really interesting life and have things to say about it. So thank you.
Thank you, Lisa.
And back to the studio, but next week you'll want to be around. I have a wonderful, wonderful woman who's going to talk about all things transformation, 60 years old. She's a personal trainer. She makes me look like something. Ugh. And she's amazing. We're going to talk about the dragonfly. May 20th, mark your calendar. Amy Schlebaugh is coming back to finish her story. And in the meantime, have a wonderful, wonderful week. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Wine on the Vine with Lisa Mayaka, only on LA Talk Radio.